AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
It's The Wonky Show. The government has published its review of the Prevent Counter-Terrorism Strategy. We'll work out if campuses really are a breeding ground for extremism. We'll also discuss this week's reshuffle and its implications for HE. There's a new report on graduate outcomes and earnings. And the government's short courses trial. What's going on there? It's all coming up.
You know, the children of my friends who are now going down this journey where I have to sort of sit them down and explain to them, you know, all of the sources of information that they could draw on. And the only reason that I did that, my career is actually a bit of a failure. If I'd been any better as an actor, I would be earning far less and I wouldn't have a pension at all.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Wonky's associate editor Jim Dickinson, and here to explain what on earth is going on, as usual, three cracking characters of HE. In Egham, Julie Sanders is principal at Royal Holloway University of London. Julie, your highlight of the week, please.
Well, obviously, Jim, one of the highlights was hosting a visit to our lovely Egham campus by one Vivian Stern yesterday, which included a very unexpected appearance by a muntjac deer. But I also have to say, last night, an astonishing one-woman performance, which was responding to classical texts and a discussion panel with our drama students, in which for a brief moment they allowed me to talk about my research. So always spend time with your students, it's a good rule.
Excellent. And in Bloomsbury, Vivian Stern is Chief Exec at Universities UK. Viv, your highlight of the week, please.
Well, obviously my highlight of the week was going to see Julie yesterday in Royal Holloway and the monk deer, which was a real surprise. But, you know, a close second was receiving my MBE from the King on Tuesday.
Brilliant. And in Darlington this week, David Kernahan is Associate Editor at Wonky. DK, your highlight of the week, please.
I'm just going to say the number 33, and hopefully we will come to that later in the podcast.
How mysterious. So yes, we start this week with the reshuffle. Rishi Sunak followed through his campaign promise to set up a dedicated energy ministry. And there were other changes of interest to the sector too, Julie.
Yeah, absolutely. So the government reshuffle this week, I suppose the demise of BEIS, the Department for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy, four new departments. Most of interest, I think, to our discussion, one on energy security and net zero, and the new Department of Science, Innovation and Technology, the acronym that we're all going to use, yet to be confirmed, led by Michel Donnellan, of course, briefly Culture, Media, Sport Minister, even more briefly Education Minister, before that, of course, Higher Education Minister. I think in the higher education scientific community, some positive responses to that, a sense of a focus on key issues, not least climate action context. Work looks really possible in this context. But as ever, worry that restructures, reorganisations actually presage several months of focusing on administrative processes and movements and not real action. I guess it really is the completion of the demise of the UK industrial strategy, if there was ever any doubt. But a new honed focus on science being welcomed. Some questions, I guess, to discuss about where it might sit in the pecking order for Treasury's support right now.
Vivian, behind the scenes, when these things happen, is it as disruptive as we're sometimes led to believe?
Well, I don't know. You always worry about where the sort of people who've been very heavily involved in significant topics are going to end up. So, I mean, I was quite relieved to see that some of the key civil servants who've been working on Horizon Alternatives and the association question are still in place in the new department. But there's always this slight risk that you lose the kind of knowledge that's built up on topics that in some cases are quite, you know, detailed and technical. And
actually, there's that risk without a reshuffle, let alone when there's a kind of structural change, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe it's just me getting old, but when reshuffles happen, sometimes you just have a big old sign. You think, oh God, we're going to have to start all over again. I mean, I guess with this one, George Freeman sticking around, I think is broadly speaking a great thing. And then Michel Donnellan, I imagine there will be sort of, you know, maybe a variety of opinions about whether this is a good thing or a bad thing. I have to say on Michel Donnellan, I always found when I was on the international side that she really got and championed the international student bit. So I hope she's going to be rolling out and backing us cabinet in the current arguments we're having about that. And the second is, I've always thought that the sort of erosion of the connection of policy terms between higher education and research was just a bad thing. And so the fact that she understands the higher education patch is going to be, I think, helpful to us.
DK, I mean, look, if I was a Secretary of State that was about to be kind of vaguely responsible for the first time that Eurovision has been hosted in the UK for decades, and then I got moved 2 months, 3 months before it happened, I'd be furious. But that aside, there are a lot of junior ministers that kind of just do what they're told to do, that then become secretaries of state, that then become kind of much more interesting and creative, aren't there?
It is the case. I mean, we do see, I think Michelle Donnellan's always had her own personality, her own approach. She did do a little bit of the old culture wars thing in her time at higher education, but you always got the impression it was never quite as much as Gavin Williamson or maybe the team at number 10 at the time would have liked her to have done. Whether or not you agree with her, she is a serious person. She is a capable person. My colleague Debbie McVitie liked to talk about her kind of girly SWAT energy, which I think is a great encapsulation of the kind of mindset. She takes things seriously. She does the reading. I think that she is a sensible and capable appointment to a department that is obviously a priority. But I just wanted to say something about the sector response, if I may. There's been a few people around the sector. I mean, Jonathan Simons at Public First did an article on this on CapEx, I think it was, lamenting the fact that we don't have universities in this department. And I think deep down, lamenting the fact that we don't have a department with the name universities in the title. Historically, the idea of universities being in a department at all is actually rather an aberration. For the largest part of the 20th century, it was kind of the University Grants Commission was kind of vaguely fastened onto the Treasury. It didn't report into a minister at all. It just got given the money and told to get on with it. And although it is good to see that the government paying more attention to science and thinking about its investment in science, and that the person responsible for making those decisions, as Vivian says, has got an interest and understanding in the work of universities. I think there's a few people in the sector who might be thinking, you know, can't they just leave us alone to get on with stuff?
I guess I think you can read this in two ways. You can say, isn't this fantastic, as a signal that government right at the top thinks that investment in research and innovation is key to national economic prosperity. It's so important that there should be a whole department focused on it, and there should be a seat at the cabinet table for the research and science base. I think that that's the positive way of looking at it, and I'm a glass half full person, so that's what I'm going with. There are other people who think, okay, this department's whole focus will be tinkering with what UKRI and the academies do, and that there has been a tendency recently to become much more sort of interventionist, micromanagey in the way that the research system works. And I think that, you know, there could be downsides to that. So we just have to keep an eye on how much the government believes that it is politicians and civil servants who can make the best decisions about how research funding should be deployed in the national interest. My view is actually that's probably not the right mindset.
Yeah, I mean, I was just going to pick up on that point about, you know, universities not in the title. And I think there are regrets. I think there's also regret that everything becomes focused on science when what we need are collaborative labs and projects. That said, I think the plus about Michelle Donnellan, you know, we've had such a problem in so many of the offices, a brief 10 years, but at least she did have that time with higher education during the pandemic, when I have to say, like Vivian, behind the scenes, I actually found her very helpful. She was always in touch. She was always available for discussions. And she has that knowledge from that work and those relationships she built then that can maybe start to respond to some of the things like the chronic lab shortage that we know is a UK issue for science and innovation.
DK, what happened to those stories a few weeks ago? Was it months ago? I lose track. That were being leaked maybe from the Treasury about UKRI. Have they all disappeared?
We've not heard anything about UKRI for a while. We're still waiting for the review of the way it works, of course. And that might point to some changes in the way that science is managed and funded, and no successive science ministers, and we've had a fair few, have been concerned about bureaucracy. But also researchers are concerned about fairness and making sure that a larger but still limited pot gets itself into the pockets of people who can actually do interesting research with it. And I think that's fair enough as well. I should also mention ARIA at this point just started advertising for program managers this week. Looks like a fascinating job, but the whole of ARIA is just basically £8 million of complete blue sky thinking, really, isn't it? You know, so the success or otherwise of what ARIA does, and crucially the way in which ARIA, as a trailblazer for the idea of blue skies research, just letting academics, the smart people, get on with things and getting out of the way, the way that's perceived in the media, I think is going to be absolutely key. So the appointment there to watch is who is going to be press officer.
Yes, reach for the moon, as S Club 7 once said. Now, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, I'm Kev McStravick, and this week in Wonky, I've been blogging about how student governors perceive power. Student membership of governing body is a long-established tradition in UK and Irish higher education, yet not a lot is known about students' experience in these governor roles. In the blog, I outline a recent study carried out with current and previous university student governors that explores the physical and symbolic manifestations of power they experienced, and looks specifically at how and if these perceptions differ between in-person and online governing body meetings. The study uncovered numerous challenges students face in learning to play the game of governance, and considered the importance of personal relationships for building confidence and capacity among student governors.
Now, next up, the government has published its long-awaited independent review of its counter-terrorism strategy, and the sector comes in for some criticism, DK.
So this is the Shawcross review of Prevent. It's been rolling along since 2021 and finally appeared this week. The headline's pretty much as we'd expect. Prevent takes an expansive approach to right-wing extremism, but when it comes to Islamic ideology linked terrorism, it's a little bit too narrow. So I mean, that's been the headlines, that's been what everybody has been talking about, but there's a bunch of stuff on universities. Shawcross has spotted and did not like the fact that universities and institutes on balance are not fans of the Prevent program as it currently stands. He talks about false perceptions around the statutory requirements of Prevent, and he laments a strikingly low number of Prevent referrals from HE.
Yeah, now inter-channel. Yeah.
Inter-channel, yeah. I mean, this is interesting in that you'd think if there's not very many referrals from the university system itself into Prevent, you'd think perhaps universities might be seen as being quite good at dealing with extremist and radicalizing voices on campus. And meanwhile, in another part of Whitehall, which is coming to the conclusion, as I'm sure we'll get to, of the Higher Education Freedom of Speech Bill that explicitly recognizes that universities are good and need to get much better at allowing a full diversity of opinion on campus. So it's interesting times. The response from the National Union of Students in particular was incredibly robust. The report says that the NUS has provided a platform for others to spread misinformation on Prevent, which I feel is maybe a little strong. NUS themselves come back with a critique that the report claims the link between Prevent and Islamophobia is false, but they've got survey evidence and data that they claim speaks for itself, and the particular impact of the Prevent legislation on the vast, overwhelming majority of Muslim students who've got no interest in terrorism or anything linked to it whatsoever. That is a huge and well-documented issue. So there's a lot in here, really, to unpack.
Well, he mentions universities, and it's really important that as a feature of William Shawcross's report, he talks about the extent of anti-prevent activity on university campuses. And indeed, in some of the very tragic cases that he goes through, there are instances where terrorists who have brought terror and destruction to innocent victims in the UK have been effectively radicalised on campus. It's absolutely vital that we take meaningful steps to ensure that there is no platform within universities for these campaigns.
Vivian, let's explore the freedom of speech stuff for a second. I mean, you know, it feels to me like we've had a couple of years of the government saying, there's too much restrictions, too much risk assessment. You've got to let people speak and debate things. And then yesterday, Suella Braverman stood up in the Commons and said we ought to have no platform for criticism of Prevent. I mean, are we through the looking glass?
Well, it's certainly very frustrating. And I think what is particularly frustrating is the suggestion that universities and the leadership of universities are somehow willfully either, you know, curtailing or constraining free speech, or on the other side, that they are, they're providing platforms for people to express dangerous views. And I think that there is something here about the distinction between violent and nonviolent extremism, and the suggestions that Prevent could be a mechanism for dealing with what I would see as entirely legitimate, if vociferous, protest. And I think what I would like people to, what we need to move into a space where it is understood that that navigating an institutional path between these different pieces of legislation is extremely difficult. And for any institution that's trying to preserve harmonious relationships on campus, it's not simple. And I worry a little bit, especially with the implementation of the freedom of speech legislation and the arrival on the scene of the Office for Students, that there are people on both sides of this argument that would like to pretend this is very straightforward and simple, and it isn't.
Yes, I just want to keep kind of rattling sabres and threatening, rather than kind of help. And that's for universities, let alone for students' unions trying to navigate that balance. Very, very difficult. Julie, one of the things he does raise is this question about the extent to which, in particular, academic staff should be kind of, you know, compelled to take part in Prevent training. And that has been controversial around the sector, hasn't it?
It is controversial. I mean, I think an offering of opportunities of training, but that training has to in itself be open to debate and discussion. That's what academics do. You know, they're trained in critical thinking. They're trained to ask why. They're trained to look at the research. And that's what we want. I mean, some of the things that the report's pulling out, like a deeper attention to anti-Semitism, well, some of that best work is going on in academic thinking through applied research and work with communities. I mean, it feels sometimes like you can do nothing right. I sometimes read these reports and the sort of use of language and put ourselves in the shoes of the legal teams, but the events teams at universities who have just worked really hard to do this. And to use the phrase like strikingly low number of referrals, well, maybe it's just the right number of referrals because people are doing their job well. And to have a phrase like no platform somehow associated at the same time as those same groups are trying to deal thoughtfully and well as ever with the free speech debate, it just feels problematic. And I think there's little evidence and some really questionable associations. In the report, it sort of implies that certain terrorist attacks took place and some people went to university. And it sort of sits there in the report. And I think it's really, really difficult. There are teams who have worked incredibly hard here to manage a complex space and to create brave and, safe spaces of dialogue and working with the students' union. I think it's a credit to universities, and it would be nice, actually, if some people could get on the ground and see what that felt like day to day.
DK, talking about kind of being on the ground, one of the things that Shawcross, takes a run at is effectively risk-based regulation. Effectively, Shawcross is saying, look, OFS doesn't kind of routinely turn up with a clipboard and find out whether you're rolling out your prevent training. It has this kind of mysterious risk-based, profile for each institution, and largely that regulation is desk-based. Where will that land, do you think?
So the prevent regulatory stuff, the prevent data return, of course, is where we get the marvellous statistics about the low number of invited speaker opportunities on campus that are cancelled, and the even lower number that are cancelled for mysterious other reasons. OFS has always set out that it wants to be a risk-based regulator, that it wants to reduce burden. Although, of course, at the moment, it's now doing the whole boots on the ground thing, which is an almost complete reversal of that position. I think at the end of the day, certain parts of the government, certain parts of our political system would like to see people going into universities and telling them what to do and telling them what they can't do, what they shouldn't be doing. This all reminds me of back at the start of the career of Ronald Reagan. It was his thing, it was his stick to go into universities and say, look at all the dreadful things students are being taught and encouraged to do. Look at the dreadful behavior of students protesting and having free speech and stuff like that. And isn't this dreadful? And there is a mindset of that in some of the government's approach to universities, that it would just be better if we could just get in there, get our boots on the ground and tell them what to do. In reality, as Julie has just told us, these are really difficult, really nuanced decisions. Getting the balance right between allowing freedom of speech, allowing this stuff to be discussed, and getting the bleach of sunlight onto some of these really disturbing ideas that are coming up. I was surprised not to read the word incel actually in the report. And I think this is something that we're going to see a lot more of, that kind of ideology, the Andrew Tate stuff, as presenting a problem on campus. And I think the response of universities of that is going to be interesting. But it needs to be nuanced. It needs to be personalized. And I don't think a blanket approach of inspections is the way to make that work.
Interesting. Now, while we're on the kind of balance between freedom from harm and freedom to speak, the free speech bill was back in the Commons list this week. Let's have a little listen.
And the bill will protect academic freedoms and encourage freedom of speech on campus in a number of ways. But the cornerstone of the bill, the cutting edge, is Clause 4, the clause that the other place has attempted to remove and that the government is rightly insisting to reinsert. Now, Clause 4 has a simple purpose. It will allow students or academics who have had their free speech rights infringed to sue the university or student union that has targeted them. In other words, it will allow academics to seek rapid redress in a financially affordable way. Without this clause, the free speech protections included in the bill can only be enforced by an independent regulator, which will likely take months to resolve any disputes, or by bringing a judicial review against the university in question, which is prohibitively expensive for almost all students and academics. So in effect, the clause provides a kind of instant feedback mechanism that will dissuade universities from acting to restrict freedom of speech in the first place. And without a tort, the student would have to resort to a judicial review with costs in excess of £100,000 to secure their rights. And if this were the case, it would be sensible to assume that the universities would be far less likely to uphold their freedoms in the first place, especially if they're coming under considerable internal pressure, as we have heard. So the tort is essential to protect academic freedoms, and I thank the Minister wholeheartedly for taking the time to listen to academics, to free speech campaigners, and for standing firm on this despite their Lordship's best efforts to move her.
Two former Conservative universities ministers, the two arguably who've had the most impact on our higher education system over the last 13 years, both saying that the tool provided by Clause 4 is wrong, both backing Lord's Amendment 10. And it didn't stop there.
Vivian, how's this going to turn out? Is the talk going to be a backstop or a front stop, do you think?
I think we'd probably get the talk back. It's really depressing, isn't it, that we've tried to... there have been some improvements in the government position on the talk in terms of restricting its applicability, but I suspect they'll reinstate it.
But as a backstop or a front stop, do you think?
I don't know.
50-50, flip a coin. Flip a coin type. Very good. DK, has it been rescheduled yet? Do we have any sense of...
We don't have a date for it yet. Lord's consideration of Commons Amendment, the whole ping-pong thing, it tends to be kind of snuck in the boundaries of other bits, so it might not even show up on the order paper until the day itself. This first one, I suspect, and I think I've said on the site or on a daily or something, that the negotiations between the key people in the Lords, like David Willetts, like Joe Johnson, and the Department for Education, are going to be key here. This is the way in which compromises via a process called, in a delightfully UK parliamentary way, the usual channels. So that's the discussions that are going on at the moment. How far can DfE move to keep the Lords happy? How far can the Lords move to give DfE what they want? I suspect we're going to see something on the face of the bill about the fact that you need to exhaust other approaches before you do this. I think that's the obvious concession that the government needs to make. How long it takes is anyone's guess, really.
Now, new balls, please. We've got an event coming up in a few weeks, and here's someone called Jim to tell us more. Hi, it's Jim from the team here with news of The Secret Life of Students. Back for its fourth year, we're going to take the opportunity to get real about students, bringing together sector leaders and managers, as well as student leaders and students' union managers, to get an accurate and unvarnished picture of the student condition in 2023, so we can work out how to respond rather than just react. Shifting from a surface-level understanding of student satisfaction with services to a deeper understanding of their motivations, ambitions and lives can be hugely rewarding and important both for them and those supporting them. It's also vital in an age that seems quick to assume, judge and condemn students rather than listen, understand and act on their concerns. So at the event, we'll be asking questions like, what are students doing when they're not in the classroom? Where is the line between their desire to collaborate and regulations that ban collusion? Is it true they're not prepared to debate and discuss controversial issues? Why do they rate assessment and feedback so badly on the NSS? And how many are confident about being real students, let alone what comes next? On the day, we'll feature key findings into the student experience from the past year. We'll launch exciting new research into the student learning experience beyond the classroom. And we'll launch our new student insights platform, Belong, a wonky group GTI initiative, and we'll share the first findings from its research. It's an essential event for anyone working on policy and delivery for students. That's The Secret Life of Students, London, March the 14th. We'd love to see you there. Go to wonky.com/events and book now.
Okay, so I've been trying to find out what's been happening with the short course trial. This is a thing the government are doing in advance of the start of the LLE, and we just saw that bill land in Parliament last week. And I've been trying to find out how many students are actually signing up for this full deal. The idea you can do a short course and get an undergraduate-style student loan to pay for it. We asked, Emma Hardy, Member of Parliament for Hull and Hessle, asked... back in September, and we were told there were 12 students that had signed up for this, which didn't sound like very many, but the caveat from Andrea Jenkins was that a lot of these courses are going to start from January 2023. So it seemed reasonable for Emma to ask again in 2023. She did, and Halfen told her that we currently have no plans to publish any specific data, which means that they're quite embarrassed about this. So I got in touch with the student loans company. They told me there have been 33 applications for student finance as a part of this short courses trial. So for 104 odd courses in 20 plus institutions, all kinds of stuff going on, all kinds of opportunities, the government's big policy push, only 33 people have been interested enough to actually want to take out this loan. Now, this to me asks a lot of questions on the LLE. It's always been a great idea to expand skills provision, short courses, bite-sized learning, giving learners what they want. And it is clear learners are interested in short courses because loads of universities run them. But it's not clear that learners want undergraduate-style student loans for them. Not clear they want to be making however long the repayments are. Not clear they really want higher education credit. There's a lot of demand-side research needs to be done on the LLE before we move to legislation and making it happen. So that's my number of the week, if I can start a little podcast thing like that. Number 33, 33 applications for student finance as part of the short courses trial.
Fascinating stuff, and there's more on that on the site. Now, finally this week, a new report out from the Social Mobility Commission is interesting. Vivian, why is it interesting?
I think this is a very interesting report indeed. It's a report by the Social Mobility Commission on the labour market value of higher and further education courses, which tries to look at the value add of HE and FE. And defining that, I suppose this is probably something pretty well understood by most of the audience, but comparing earnings with those who studied for a particular qualification compared to those who did not, but also accounting for prior attainment, geography, measures of disadvantage, school, and other kind of personal characteristics. So before you account for all of those things, at 29, those who attended higher education, undertook higher education programs, undergraduate programs, were 25% more in the case of men and 50% more in the case of women compared to those who had five GCSEs graded A star to C. But once you take into account those other factors, they adjust that to 19% advantage for men and 24% for women. But there's actually a lot of other stuff in this report, which I think bears reading.
So I think there's a really good premise behind this, which is about students having more sort of data and information and understanding when they make their choices. So students should be given more details about how the courses they study after leaving might, and it is a might, impact employment prospects. That all seems well and good, but it did strike me reading through the whole report is sort of head round with lots of possiblys and maybes and limited sample references. And I think the report in itself is very upfront about that. I'm not criticising that, but I worry that some of the stats will be and graphs will just be used as a blunt instrument without that contextualization that's been put around things, really. And language matters. And there's talk about the most selective universities hindering social mobility, about being the worst offenders. I just wish we could find a better language to engage with some of this work. And it does acknowledge, actually, that we just don't have the longitudinal figures in some cases to see where some of the scholarship and investment and access work has actually played out recently. And then, language matters with this phrase value add for me. And it does say, it's very clear in the report, of course it says students may still choose these courses for other valid reasons. They just need to be aware of the possible labour market implications. All well and good, but it's where it gets picked up in the media. And you get that, I'm going to make the same old hoary chestnut point I always make. There's questions of motivations here. There's about the kinds of careers that are about choosing social impact and social contribution. And the students I talk to around the Royal Holloway campuses are just really clear about this being a very important factor for them. And they are, many of them, students who are first in family, free school meals and all the things that factor in here. It matters if you take a business degree and you decide to use those amazing skills to work in an NGO or to work in a Citizens Advice Bureau right now, advising people on cost of living. And if you could monetize out the contribution to well-being and the economy, it's really considerable. So again, the report is good. I think it's a step towards something, but I worry about the blunt instrument use of it.
DK, have I imagined this, or is there press coverage this morning suggesting that in the report there's a recommendation to publish, graduate outcomes alongside course advertising? We've been here before, haven't we?
Not only have we been here before, we already do via the KISS widget that is now the Discover Uni widget. The thing with this report, me, is it once again we're down to LEO data. I've written so much on the site about longitudinal education outcomes data, to the extent I've expressed it as two laws of output metrics. The first law is you can't meaningfully examine output metrics without controlling for sex, background characteristics, subject, provider, region of residence, and any attempt to do this makes for an unusually small sample size. And the second law of output metrics is if you've got a data set that doesn't even recognize part-time work and the idea of a part-time salary, then you're probably on a hiding to nothing. So this SMC stuff, it is, the report is kind of basically a literature review looking at some of the best research that's been done using these data on HE and FE by people like the IFS, by people like the team at DFE, the Future Skills Unit, all that kind of stuff. And just coming up with, what do we know about this? The key outcome is that in general, if you go to HE, your salary will be better. And in general, if you go to FE, your salary will be a bit better, but not as good as if you did an apprenticeship. And then again, not as good if you went to HE. There's lots of stuff to argue about around the size, around subject and provider choice. As Julie and Vivian have noted here, this is not the kind of thing you see in a first year economic textbook. Students, applicants do not act in this made up kind of rational homo economicus, maximizing their likely salary return way. Some students just like dancing, and I think that's fantastic that we can support the UK's professional dancers, professional dance sector, which are, in the words of many ministers, world class. And we should not worry about the fact in this part of the system that dancers don't get paid very much or don't have permanent full-time work, and we should think about reforms to the arts industry to think, actually, maybe we should support artists a little bit properly. It is good to see the Social Mobility Commission doing this stuff, getting stuck back into the evidence and the literature after a brief flight of fancy under Catherine Birbal-Singh, who has now decided to step down and focus on her core career, which is I think he's writing nonsensical articles in the Times. And it is good. It's a decent report. It's a good summary. If you're going to start a PhD in this stuff, I'd say that's a list of the key document you can read. Is it going to move the dial? No.
Thing is, though, Viv, right? Like, all three of you have done what I might call a kind of, you know, warm and comforting yeah, but balm, right? So, you know, you have to think about all the other factors, blah, 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 blah. But, you know, if I'm gawping at a higher education provider website that says, you know, boost your career, maximize your future, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then when I actually look at the small print, I'm highly unlikely to get a graduate job. I'm highly likely, if I'm on that program, on at that institution, to get significantly less than, you know, I might imagine from the photos. Is it consumer signaling and choice that should, and better information that should deal with that? Or is it, you know, regulation that should deal with that? Or shouldn't we be dealing with that at all? We should just deal with the quality of the output.
I mean, I think that they, you know, one of the things I quite like about what the Social Mobility Commission is sort of prioritizing is that I agree that the focus should be on helping predominantly, but not only, young people make a good, well-informed decision that takes into account all the things that are important to them. And I do think there's a bit of a problem with information, advice and guidance for people sort of starting on a further education or higher education pathway. So I'm all for, you know, a renewed effort to help students make good decisions for them. And I probably shouldn't rely on personal experience, but I'm a bit horrified by the, you know, the children of my friends who are now going down this journey where I have to sort of sit them down and explain to them, you know, all of the sources of information that they could draw on. But going back to the point about, we do tend as a sector to come back to this argument. Have I ever told you that the only reason that I did, that my career is actually a bit of a failure, if I'd been any better as an actor,
I would be earning far less and I wouldn't have a pension at all. And, you know, I think that it is important we make the argument, but at the same time, you know, students having good information that helps them make a decision about their path according to what seems to them important at the time, I don't see, you know, that seems to me a good thing for us all to be focusing on.
It's not really, you know, your life after you graduate, to a certain extent, it is what you're making. And if we're really concerned about graduate outcomes, we need to reform the labour market and the way we actually regulate the labour market and regulate salaries, as opposed to thinking it's all a problem we can solve with inputs when the problem, as Office for Students like to tell us, is outputs.
Well, I just wanted to sort of come back in on your point about sort of signalings in marketing collaterals, and I do think the sector needs to be careful about the kind of claims it's putting out there, but I think we also need to attend to some of our own sort of value statements that we make too, and listen to the students in this context. So Robert Halfen himself, in the recent letter to vice chancellors talking about degree apprenticeships, was talking about social justice, but actually, if we're really debating social justice, and our students on the whole are, then definitions of success are quite varied, and they aren't just about the probability of being in the X top percent of earners. And, you know, that might sound like an easy kind of pushback, but I think it really matters.
So that's about it for this week. Remember, to dig a bit deeper into anything we've discussed today, you'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget, you can get the latest show automatically when it's out. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And to find out how we can keep you and your organisation ahead of everything going on UKHE, do head to the website to find out more about our subscriptions. So thanks very much to Julie, Viv, DK and our news editor Michael Salmon, who makes the show happen behind the scenes. We'll be back next week. Mark will be here. Take care.